because they had bought it, the dam went out, and they never started the mill after that. And then the mill gradually fell down and so forth.
And who was the man who bought your father's store?
And Harrison Tiffany was the new owner of the store.
Was he from Scary?
He was originally from Scary, but at that time he lived on the North Bangor Road between Malone and North Bangor, and then moved up there.
Now, about the man who had the oxen, what were the special circumstances surrounding that?
What was what?
The special circumstances surrounding the man who drove the oxen.
Oh, well, when he was very young, he had scarlet fever, which left him both deaf and dumb. And then he went to New York City and went through the grades in high school there in that form of learning. And when he returned, he was asked to teach at the School for the Deaf here in Malone when it was started, but he couldn't because of just having one arm. And then he always drove the oxen because he could control them without fear of getting hurt himself, or because of not being able to talk or hear. And also he was handicapped with just one arm.
Right. When was the lumber yard in Malone purchased? That was...
I don't know the year that was started either.
Purchased though. When did your father buy the
lumber yard? Down here. Oh yes, that was 1918.
What were the reasons for the previous owner wanting to sell?
For what?
What were the reasons for the previous owner wanting to sell?
Oh, just to retire, just to do things that he had wanted to do when he couldn't, when he was working.
When your father bought into the lumber mill, did Burton Reynolds still have a hold in that, a share?
Yes.
He did? Was he half partner?
Yes. He bought Burton Reynolds' share, or his partner, half of the partnership.
And then for the first years that he owned the mill down here, the lumber yard down here, was he in shares with another man?
Was he what?
In shares. Did he have it on shares?
Oh, yes.
Who was that?
Yeah, that was 1918.
Who was that that he went in with?
And it's Charlie Wilding, C.W.
Right,
Wilding.
Right. And when did he buy out Wilding?
1926.
Any special reason was Wilding?
Well, Mr. Wilding wanted to retire, too. He didn't. Dad was anxious to have it for his own.
Would you know how much he paid for a half share, for Burton Reynolds' share?
No, I wouldn't. I can't remember that, no.
Do you know how much he paid to buy out Wilding?
No, I might. No, I don't know that I'd have it. I mean, I might be able to find that. I wouldn't be sure. No, I can't remember. But as I say, I might be able to look those two up, both of them.
How many employees were down there in 1918?
In 1926 or?
In 1918.
1918. Mm-hmm. I would think about 12 to 15. Now, of course, it varied at different times of the year because when the sawmill wasn't running, they didn't need as many as if it were running. Maybe. At other times of year, it might go down to 6 to 8.
There was a sawmill down on Elm Street there?
Sawmill and planing mill.
What changes took place after your father bought into the mill? What changes did he put into effect?
Well, they all always, each person always does different things they had. We built, for one thing, a shop where we had smaller machines like bandsaws, rip saws, and small planer and a sander and mortiser, and that was a quite a large shop and did a lot of millwork. That was before, in later years, the millwork, we bought most of all of our millwork, like windows and frames and different articles that we would manufacture there directly from other companies who made them in larger quantities. It'd be less, more economical.
What was the chief source of lumber? for the yard.
At what period?
In the early period.
In the early period, we bought from different people who owned land. For instance, we bought the logs from Twin Ponds that were ordered, owned by Will Clark and Moira. And then we bought logs at McCollum's that were owned by McCollum's Hotel and up through there. And then we bought logs on Upper Saranac Lake. Those were brought across and shipped down by train, carloads. We also bought logs down near Trout River. Some of them were in Canada and some in the United States down through there. And other people, smaller, like farmers, would cut logs to dad's specifications in the mill and bring them in and sell them to him for so much a thousand.
Would the men draw their own logs into the mill?
Yes.
Into town?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. We always had somebody who had teams and later trucks to draw the logs for us. We didn't use our own trucks or teams to draw them.
You always had the men who sold you the logs transport them?
Well, he didn't always do it, but if he didn't, we hired people who were equipped to draw them, to transport them.
Who were those men who were equipped, you know, that you were accustomed to hiring to draw logs?
I'll have to look up names. I should know quite a lot of them, but it would be a farmer, as a usual thing. It would be one of the local farmers who had a big truck and then would equip it with log chains and different things to handle the logs when they're piled on in large amounts. But it wasn't always the same ones. I mean, in those years, if a farmer had a certain time of year that he wasn't making money, he might buy a truck and log chains and so forth and do it in his spare time.
Do you remember seeing teams of horses come to the lumber yard and load?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. After I was in the early 1920s, when I was there, we had to deliver lumber. We had two teams and a single horse, and we delivered lumber as far as Moores and about 40 miles around with the teams. Sometimes the teams just had to stay overnight when they go somewhere, you know, come back. Maybe it'd be a 2 or 3 day trip with a large load of lumber.
Who were the teamsters employed by the mill?
Nelson Nephew was one of our teamsters, and Bassett was another. I just can't say his first name because there are two that I remember very long. And then later, Walter Ashlaw was one of the men that was there. Mm-hmm. They were there for years and years. I mean, almost a part of the institution, you know.
How much would your father pay for a sled load of logs for the lumber yard?
Well, of course, it would depend upon the number of feet on the logs. Each log was scaled as it was taken off, and a copy of the scale was given to them. And it's usually, and maybe in the 30s around, it was about $45 a thousand delivered in there, if they were their logs. And then it worked up to the last, when we finished sawing, 65 to 85 thousand.
Mm-hmm. How was a log scaled?
At the small end. We have a scale rule, and a 12-inch log, 12-foot long, is 48. There was 48 feet in it, and that was by Scribner's rule, which was more. They had two rules, Scribner's and Doyle. And Doyle was for the hardwood and Scribner's for the saw. Uh-huh. Then if it was a 14-foot, it went up so much, and 16 so much more in it.
Could you describe Doyle's rule, how it worked?
Did it what?
Doyle's rule, how that worked.
Well, and the same thing in Doyle's rule, it would be quite a bit less. Usually, hardwood, which they do in larger amounts. I mean, they didn't cut a small hardwood tree because there would be so much cinder or sap in it, that hard in it, that it wouldn't be good. Mm. So that they measured hardwood by the Doyle rule and softwood by Scribner to get them.
They would take the width at the smallest end and multiply it by the length?
No, it's just the diameter of it. And for instance, if a log there was 48 feet in the 12-foot log, then we would add a 6 more if it was 14. That would be 54. If it was 16, it would be a third more.
So it was an approximation, really.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, I'm still not exactly clear on the difference between Doyle's and Scribner's rule.
That it was a rule that was made up, and it's the rule is about 3 feet long, and it has the scale, all the different lengths there, and it goes up so that you know for 16 feet just how many it is. That's all worked out for you, so you can scale fast. But Doyle rule didn't give the customer as many feet for the same log as the Scribner, so that we bought all softwood by Scribner. Mm-hmm. And then hardwood, which gave when you got to a 16-inch log, the number of feet in Doyle and Scribner was more nearly the same. So that in order to discourage them bringing in a 6-inch hardwood log, it would be only, I think it was 6 feet that you'd give them for a 6-inch, 12-foot hardwood. And they wouldn't like it. So we would just soon have spruce down to 6 inches, because you could get 2x4s and so forth out of them. They didn't begin giving them really the correct amount of feet for the log until it got up larger, and that discouraged the cutting of small hardwood. They'd use it for wood. Hmm.
Did you buy much of your lumber from Reynolds Brothers from 18 to 22 or 24?
From who?
Did you buy much of your lumber at the mill down here from Reynolds Brothers a few years they ran?
No, I don't remember that we did very much, no. We were always on very good terms with all of the Reynolds and knew them well, but I don't think that it worked out that we bought from them. I think that we had enough sources and they had enough sources that we'd sell. We'd buy our logs and saw them and they would, and then we'd ship them out.
Did you ever sell any lumber to the paper company here in Malone?
And
softwood?
We always sold, one of the Malone Paper Company was one of our customers, yes, for anything that they did. They were one of our big customers.
What would they buy?
Well, it would just depend on what they were doing. They didn't buy it for their paper. They bought it to maintain their buildings and things like that. If they needed a new storeroom or something, or if they needed to repair their buildings as they kept along, we sold them.
Mm-hmm. How many hours a day did your father spend at the mill?
Down here, if I remember correctly, I think that when he was there, it was nearly always 8 to 5, but he spent a good many hours at different times getting ready. He would be there probably an hour before in the morning and an hour later at night. And there was a great deal of seeing that all the saws were sharpened and he had men to do them. But he had to oversee it, and to be sure that the mill was oiled before they started, everything taken care of to be in perfect working form. Because when you have, say, 10 men working in a mill, if you lose 15 minutes because of a shutdown, you lose money, and accordingly, and you, in order to be to make money, you have to be very efficient, I think.
Mm-hmm. Was there any other lumber yard in Malone?
The Malone Milling Company was here at that time. That was Earl Mayer, Laird Earl Mayer and Son.
Were they a bigger operation than you were?
I would think it would be comparable. Later they did contracting work when we didn't do contracting work, but no, I wouldn't think they were any larger.
Did they carry on their business any differently, deal with a different type of wood?
It was a little bit different. They had a sawmill also, we were competitors. We were always trying to outsell the other. But I just think it'd be really quite kind of comparable,
Mm-hmm. Were you friendly competitors?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. What kind of saws did you have in the saw in the sawmill.
Circular saws.
Run by electricity?
Not at first. When we were first out there, we had a man who ran the boiler. There was a steam boiler in the end of a shop that ran the mill. And he was there day and night. He lived there. I mean, he was a single man. He stayed out there. So to be sure there was no fire and everything. Fire is always dangerous when they use sawdust to burn, you know. And then later it was changed to electricity.
Were there any other saws in the sawmill?
Were any of them what?
Any other saws in the sawmill?
Oh, well, yes, you see, there was the circular saw, and then there was the edger, and then there was the slab saw, and the trimmers, all in the sawmill.
How high was the circular saw?
48 inches in diameter. 48 to 52. Sometimes we had 52 inch. And then as they were filed, they might get down to 48 inches. They gradually wear down when they were filed. And also some of them were teeth that were put in, loose teeth rather than solid.
Mm-hmm. Did the circular saw sit in the floor?
No, it was, it did go down below the floor level, maybe a third of the way, and the rest of it came up. And it was run, ours was what we call a left-hand lane mill, run by, because he stood on the right of the saw and guided the carriage with his left hand. If the saw was here, and the saw carriage was here, and went by, and then the sawyers guided it with his left hand.
Stand on the right side of the saw, guide the lumber with the left hand. Uh-huh. What were the other types of mills?
They had right-hand sawmills, just same thing, and then they also had band saws, but they didn't have as many band saws around here. Now, I think in Tupper Lake, some of their big saws and so forth were band saws, but all of the smaller mills around here were circular.
Band saws were also early.
Yes.
They were an earlier type of saw.
Now, for instance, out on the West Coast, Pacific Lumber Company, anything like that, where they had big redwood logs and everything, they'd always be band saws because they could work down and take care of a larger log in diameter. We've seen some of those logs out there. They made ours look puny because you could get enough lumber in one log, one tree, for a whole house.
Did you ever hear your father talk about the Webster Mill?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. The Webster Mill was run by my uncle, Hiram Kenny, between here and Lake Titus. That's the one you mean there?
There was also an early Webster Mill in Scary.
Oh.
It was running just after the Civil War. Uh-huh. It used the band saws, the upper
they did.
Band saws.
Uh-huh. Well, now I've forgotten about that. He might have talked about it. And it might be that something that Catherine, who was his sister, was there with him when they went up to Scary. She might have known something about that. If she did, she'll put it on those pictures. He probably has talked about it, but then it would go on, and when you're young, you sometimes forget or overlook things that have been told you not to.
Yeah. And where was your uncle's mill?
There used to be a mill right across from Warner's, halfway between here and Lake Titus, and it was run by Plunkett Webster, and he took care of that. I would say maybe when around 1908 or 10, somewhere along that time. I've forgotten just when it was.
How big a mill was that?
It was as large or maybe larger than the Scary Mill. And I think that it was maybe newer at that time. But they just ran it until they cut out that section, and then they closed the mill.
Did that run by water power?
It was on the river, but I wouldn't be sure. Although I was there a great deal of time in between, but I can't remember.
What were the saws at that mill?
That I'm sure was circular.
Mm-hmm. Did they have a planing mill there?
No, I don't remember a planing mill. I think that nearly all of the lumber was shipped rough. Uh-huh. Because down here, not many mills had planing. We had a large planing mill here. And at that time, there wasn't any duty on rough lumber from Canada, where they bought a lot of lumber from Canada and the United States. And so that we ran what you call a transit mill. Lumber came in on one car on one side of our mill, and it was put through the planer and went loaded into the other one and sent out, so that, because they could have it planed here cheaper than having it planed in Canada. And that was until maybe in the 30s. And then they took the duty off of rough, and so it was cheaper because they didn't have to reload it. They have it done in Canada where they bought the lumber.
They had no duty before the 30s on planed lumber, did they?
They had a duty on planed, but not on the rough. See, so we planed it here. And it made it cheaper for if you were a lumber company in New York City or somewhere and you brought from one of the Canadian Pacific companies, they would ship it rough to us and here, and then we'd plane it and send it on.
Mm-hmm. But if you sent lumber into Canada, you would send it rough instead of planed.
If we sent it?
If you sent lumber into Canada, you wouldn't want to pay the duty on planed lumber, so you send it rough.
The lumber never went that way. They having more logs and things, it always came this way.
I see. Did they have the trimmers, the edgers, and the other saws at Webster's Mill on the Lake Titus Road?
They would always have trimmers, because that would get them to the 12 or 14, 16 feet long, and that would save a lot of space in piling. See, then it was sorted for lengths as it went through the trimmer or out to the yard to dry.
How many buildings were there at the Webster Mill?
I think at that time there were just one quite large sawmill, and their big home. They had a very big home there too, and I think all the lumber was piled outdoors, lumber and wood. It was a lot of wood, of course, slab wood.
Who were some of the workers besides your uncle?
Well, I know that up there that there were a great many of the Warners and Jedwares that were up there. I remember those, but I can't remember who their sawyers and other men were. But I think that all of the men, the Williams and Jedwares, Warners, and really all of the people that have lived them along that road for a long time or worked there.
Did that mill have company houses that were
owned by
Plunkett Webster?
No, they're just there and just brought in and so forth.
Could you describe the trimming saw you had down here by Elm Street?
The what?
Trimming saw.
Mm-hmm. Well, the saw was maybe we'll say 16 feet long, and there was a circular saw at each end, and then these saws worked on a little bar that you moved in front of the one who was handling it, and the saws would move back and forth to certain length, like 12, 14, 16, as the board was pushed through. And they worked easy enough so they come through in different lengths and the man could see right away just what it was and it went right through.
Who ran that?
Can't remember in our time, but quite a few of our men would know how. I mean, if I had payrolls, I'd remember it, but I just can't remember it now, some of them.
And then you had an edger.
A big pardon?
An edger, you had an edger?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. What was that like?
The edger, there was one saw that worked, really one on each side, but one was loose, and moved back so that the board was put through like this. Then the man knew he could get an 8-inch board out of it. He moved that to that 8-inch, and it went through and ripped it both sides, so it was ripped squarely on both sides.
It went first through the bandsaw, and then to the trimmer, and then to the edger?
No. First one, it was a circular saw.
Circular saw.
And then through the edger, and then through the trimmer.
Mm-hmm. And what was after the edger? Was there any other saw then?
On the left was the slab saw.
Oh.
And see, as the slabs were taken off, they were shot down on this roller conveyor from the saw, which ran back and forth on the carriage. There was a man there that picked them up as they were dropped from the carriage and slid them down to the man who worked on the slab saw.
Mm-hmm. Was the slab saw the last saw of the operation?
Yes, it was opposite the etcher on the opposite side of the mill.
Mm-hmm. This cut the wood into chunks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That, so, yeah, and usually at that time it was mostly always 12 inches long, and it ran out on a conveyor belt. And then there was either a single horse and a box sled when it would dump underneath there, and then when it got full, it was taken out to the yard and dumped and piled.
By this time, all the bark was off the wood, and it was white.
Mm-hmm. They kept turning the log. The sire would take one slab off and then turn it, take another off, and keep turning the log until the log was square. Then he'd cut, like 2x12, 10s, or 2x8, anything he wanted off of that. Or if they were looking some 5/4 lumber, he'd cut that, or 3/4.
What's 5/4 and 3/4?
Very much for flooring, porch floorings, and then for fascias and frieze on homes, and he racks.
It's 5/4 what?
Yeah, 5/4 thick. That means it's an inch and a quarter.
I see.
Thick, yeah. Mm-hmm. When, of course, when it's sawed rough, they allowed enough more on that board. That would be from 1/8 of an inch to 3/8 more, so that it could run through the planer and be planed on both sides. Still be enough lumber.
Mm-hmm. You must have had lumber that was much longer than 12 inches.
12 foot. Yes, it went. Usually, the standards here were more of 12 to 16 feet. They all, in a sawmill here, we would have odd lengths. If you'd buy it, you didn't buy like odd lengths, but here we would save if we had a 9 foot or a 13 foot or anything like that, that would be piled separately so that you could. But no. Because of efficiency, again, nothing, very, very seldom do you ever get an odd length. It always goes in 2 foot length. And of course, we'd go up when we were sawing ourselves, usually to 20 feet. And sometimes we'd buy 24 feet from the West Coast. It's harder to handle on cars, and then it'll warp more easily than a shorter length. So that there's a little loss on it, and that's why there isn't so much long handle.
Now, what was your planing mill like down here?
The planing mill had a Yates 91 planer, which was a fast planer. We could plane a carload of lumber up to 30,000 feet in a day it went. So I've forgotten just how many feet per minute. It was a very fast planer, and it could plane and match and shiplap and dress four sides. And then we had the railroad tracks went on each side of the plane mill, so went in one side and out the other. And then we had a cutoff saw there, and a small edger, and a big band saw. The big band saw could make clapboards or cut different types. It could tilt and cut in any way they wanted.
Clapboards are cut at an angle.
Right, uh-huh.
The planer was basically a plane.
Right, uh-huh.
It wasn't really a saw.
The knives were filed and set in a long roller. We could plane up to 24 inches wide. And they were filed and set in this roller at maybe 6-inch intervals, and then they revolved at a very high speed as the board went through. And it planed planed on both the top and bottom at the same side. There was the top plane that rolls and the bottom rolls.
Did the knife stick a long ways out?
No, less than an inch, because that held it hardly, very tight.
When they were playing, they didn't leave the surface irregular.
No.
They just left it smooth.
No. See, they had to be very careful to have those knives filed perfectly so there wasn't any irregularity in it.
I would think a series of knives, even revolving at a fast speed, would leave chunks.
Uh-huh. See, they had to be set perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
But they were. They were very... Well, you had to be very careful because it would take off of the place of the lumber, or if something went through wrong, they'd immediately get word back and something. You'd have to decrease your price and lose your profit.
Wow. How was wainscoting made? How was that?
Beg your pardon?
Wainscoting, how was that made?
Brainstone is made out of rough lumber and on a bandsaw.
You call it brainstone?
Uh-huh.
What is that?
Well, it's the bark is left on, mm-hmm. too, as well, so that it's, and then it's just tapered slightly, and it's rough. And then when it's stained, it shows all the knots and the roughness and also the irregularity of the outside bark.
Is that used for paneling?
No, it's used for, for instance, you take up at Meacham. The cabins that are built there are made of brainstorm siding on the outside. It looks very rustic. And a great many people build their camps or anything in the woods. It looks very nice.
Hmm. How was wainscoting made?
And the wainscoting made was just like in a planer, only it was set so that it was very thin and had a bead on it. You had your knife with a little bead on it,
right.
Planed and matched and beaded. And in some mills, they beaded it on both sides and then ripped it or bandsawed it again in the center because it was so thin. They could do a thick board and do it both sides and then rip it because wainscoting only needed to be 3/8 of an inch thick.
Is wainscoting matched lumber with a groove and a tongue?
Mm-hmm.
How are the groove and tongue produced by the saw?
On our planer, we had these, we always called them different knives, that were set right in place. And so if you were going to run a carload of 6-inch mats, they were set so that there was a tongue on one side and a groove on the other as they went through. And every board would be put.